Side 2, Tape 1, interviewing Dr. Kleonski.
Yeah, so my wife attended Grants College while we were in medical school, while I was in medical school, and taught Hebrew at nursery school at the time at Temple Har Zion in Philadelphia. Then for a number of years devoted herself to raising and rearing our children. But when Danny came to an age, she then went back to school, first got a master's degree, and then a doctorate in English at Carnegie Mellon University, with her field being the poetry of the prophets. And has been teaching informally ever since. Has not really worked at it in a paying way because she can't drive, and the working opportunities would be she's taught a semester at Pitt, she taught a semester or two at Chatham College, but essentially is a full-time, you know, student, and every Monday night for the last 17, 18 years has had a Bible study group that meets in our own home, which she conducts, and we get between 8 and 12 or 15 people, you know, who come usually for a period of many years, and we've simply gone through the cycle of reading the Chumash and the Nevi'im and the apocryphal books and the Ketubim and the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then on to the New Testament and the Quran, and we started all over again.
New people.
Sometimes new people, some of them have stayed on, and so that she spends a day or two a week, you know, preparing, you know, for that. She attends two Hebrew classes a week and goes to one Shakespeare class every week for the last 18 years. The professor with whom she'd taken the course began at about that time to conduct an extramural group, I think because of to pick the brains of the bright, you know, adult women who were in his class, and that has never stopped, and I think she's the only, I tease her and say that the reason he conducts the class is for her, every Thursday, for not every Thursday minus summer's vacation, you know, but most of the year, for the last 18 years, she does her homework, you know, and reads and studies. So she's pretty much a full-time, non-paid student and teacher.
Marvelous.
Unfortunately, you know, we don't need the income.
Do you speak Hebrew?
My Hebrew is very weak. I can make myself, you know, understood with or without grammar.
You're a Yiddisher?
Pardon?
A Yiddisher? You speak Yiddish?
No, my Hebrew is probably better than my Yiddish. Again, I can make myself, you know, poorly understood in Yiddish and understand a little more than I can speak. The year we were in Israel, literally was working so much at the hospital that we were able to attend an olpan one or two evenings a week. My Hebrew improved and could get better again more quickly, but my Esther is very fluent. My wife's fluent in Hebrew.
As your children were growing up, did you in any way try to direct their educations in specific areas of interest?
We tried to direct their education Judaically, in that in the beginning my wife would try to teach them Hebrew at home, feeling that very little kids were better off not having to go to Hebrew school or extend their day, and she would teach them to read and to begin to speak a bit. felt that we needed more formal training, as our second child, Matthew, proved to be rather resistant to Mama, whereas our daughter Nina was very good. So we took him to Hillel Academy to enroll him at Hillel. The rabbi at the time asked a couple of questions, whereupon he managed to get out a word or two, and Nina answered in complete sentences. The rabbi said, "She's the one we want." So we ended up sending both of them, you know, to Hillel. And for some reason, our daughter Ruth, we didn't, and then when Danny came along, he too went. So the three of the four, you know, went to Hillel. Directing their education otherwise, no. We always encouraged, you know, as broad, everybody in the house, you know, read and had books and was doing things, and they saw a variety of activities. In fact, it was somewhat a shock to me and a surprise that my two older children both went into medicine. I always had assumed that my daughter Nina was going to be an historian or a concert musician or an English professor.
Does she play an instrument?
Yes, she was a very fine pianist. but I was surprised to see her studying courses in college that looked like she was heading to medicine. I said, you know, what happened? She said, I never knew so many people who so thoroughly enjoyed what they did as my father and his friends. So she went into medicine just on blind faith that it was going to be a lot of fun. And I don't think she's regretted it. My son Matthew was a surprise in that I always thought he was going to be a mathematician. Indeed, he began college in the gifted mathematics program at Carnegie Mellon, which he left after 2 years, and said that he felt he was of a more practical bent and really was not interested, you know, in the theoretical math, and transferred to Brandeis. And again, lo and behold, I begin to see the pre-medical courses creeping in, and very much similar reasoning. So that I don't think we ever, never steered them, to my knowledge. They're a very independent bunch. Four very different human beings.
You socialize a great deal with men in your profession.
Not a great deal, actually. You know, most of, you know, some, but most of our socializing has really been, you know, with the members of the Jewish community and with, one time with the Dor Chadash, and even though we left Dor Chadash, many of our very close friends remain from that era, and with people from Esther's acquaintances and the Bible study and the shul. No, we do obviously go to many meetings and many conferences, you know, with the members of the pathology group, but we've never really established primary social relationships on the basis of work.
Well, there are, you have many scientific people in your young people's.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, in many ways, we're a unique congregation.
Oh, yes.
In town. When the Hillel lectureship was on 2 weeks ago, 50 people are there, 20% of the audience is young people's. And you see that time and time and time again, vastly out of proportion to their numbers, they're represented in the cultural and the educational activities of the community. And I've enjoyed them very much.
I know many of them. They're marvelous. When you took your first internship, where were you?
At the University of Wisconsin, in Madison, Wisconsin.
You were married at that time?
I married after my second year of medical school. I had met my bride when I was a returning senior, returning from naval service, and met the young freshman. And during that 1 year, my senior year at college, I actually met her after half the year was gone, but in the half a year that remained, I developed enough interest to make frequent trips to Boston. And shortly after she graduated, we were married. And then she moved to Philadelphia during my last 2 years of medical school.
And were your children born during this
period? My daughter Nina was born the night before I graduated from medical school. And she was born in Philadelphia. Then the other three were born in Kansas City. You know, two of them while I was still a resident, and Danny after I was already on the faculty at the University of Kansas.
Were you doing general pathology while you were on the faculty, or were you just teaching?
Doing general pathology.
And then you came?
Then came to McGee, you know, in that specialty setting.
And stayed on in Pittsburgh.
Out of Pittsburgh. And probably will. You know, we're at the stage of our lives where you have to make the decision what you want to do when you retire. I mean, you want to go south, go to Israel, move to some city where one or more of your children are. And at least tentatively, we're seriously considering, you know, maintaining Pittsburgh. You know, as a base, even if we then do spend part of every year traveling or visiting or whatever.
I think you find among scientific people that this becomes a solid foundation in making a choice.
Yeah.
In your relationships in the community, have you developed any particular hobbies?
Hobbies related to the community activity?
Or to yourself, as a result of being in the community.
I don't think so. I mean, I've always been interested in photography, you know, and play with that. And,
every pathologist is.
Yeah. And frequently loved when I go to a wedding or a bar mitzvah, not the bar mitzvah during Shabbos, but, you know, the party afterward, I'll frequently take along my own camera, and as an extra gift, you know, to the bride and groom or the bar mitzvah, give them a roll of candid shots of what went on. I've been playing intermittently for years with my with a stamp collection that I'd begun as a kid, and that my mother, may she rest in peace, I hadn't realized had continued. It was only when she died that I realized that she had these mountains of things that she'd been trying valiantly to organize, and it failed. I mean, if ever a poor woman needed a computer, it was my woman, my mother. I found the beginnings of typed lists 20 times. She tried to organize what she had and could never do it. So after she died, my father said, "You're the only one with you, take the stamps." So I wrote a computer program to organize the material so I could record, you know, how many singles and how many plate blocks and how many regular blocks and how many first day covers and how many sheets, you know, and what is the name of the stamp and what's the catalog value and what's the face value and what's the catalog value. And I'm gradually drifting my way through all of her material and trying to put it in order, you know, in part because I'm interested, in part because that's one of the tangible remnants I had of something that she indeed had put a tremendous amount of time and effort into, you know, and had not quite succeeded, so I will end up putting all that material in order. What I'll do with it then, I don't know.
Hand it on.
What?
Hand it on.
It's a marvelous hobby.
And for years, I don't really have time anymore. I always used to love doing the things around the house. And after my training as an electronic technician's mate, I figured if a plumber can do it, I can do it. If a carpenter can do it, I can do it. You know, and that's the nature of pathology, too. You know, I say, I think like to think of the pathologist essentially as a trained problem solver. And therefore, if it was putting down tile or cutting a piece of wood or building this or building that, I did it. In the early years, I did it for fun and because it represented a saving of money. By now, when I get the time, I do things, but somehow or other, everything else has expanded And I don't do nearly as much of the fix-it stuff around the house. But that was always always fun. Especially when the kids were growing up, they learned. One of my son, an elder boy in particular, became a real mechanic and craftsman.
Do you live in the same home when you first came to Pittsburgh?
No, for the first year in Pittsburgh, we rented a house. That was my fault, because when I had an opportunity to come to Pittsburgh in advance of moving here, nominally to look for a house, I spent the time instead in the lab. Because there was an opportunity to order the electron microscope and order the equipment and begin to change the design of the lab so that a lot of that work would already be underway and the things would be here by the time I arrived. And I had come from Kansas City, where there were very homogeneous neighborhoods, where there were many new houses being built, and where I knew that for $25,000 I could buy the house of my dreams. I figured I'd walk out in Pittsburgh one afternoon and buy a house. When I decided to spend the afternoon looking for houses, they weren't there. And the real estate agents took me around, and I wanted to live in Squirrel Hill. And when they know you're in town and only have a day, such garbage they showed me. I said, I can't believe Jews live like this. Oh, broken down, dilapidated places that hadn't been... And there were clearly I couldn't turn around and buy what I wanted. What they offered to rent me... Pardon me. It was atrocious. And there were reasonable rental properties in Mount Lebanon. So for 1 year I rented... And it was actually indicative of the time in that Manny Farber, who came here as chairman of the Department of Pathology, and Herschel Sadransky, who came here as the vice chairman of the Department of Pathology, the role that I now have, all, one unbeknownst to the other, rented houses within two blocks of each other in Mount Lebanon, and all within the year were grateful to leave and move into the town. And so we, in 1962, we bought and moved into the house we're still living in.
Have you noticed any change in the characteristic of the neighborhood that you live in? Because it's a long time.
Not really dramatically. Squirrel Hill's become maybe a little bit less Jewish, but in other ways more Jewish. I mean, the percentage of Jews may have been a little smaller, and for a while you saw more of the mixed university, a few more Orientals and Blacks, but it still remains essentially the community that made it attractive, you know, sort of a cosmopolitan community with a big enough percentage of Jews to maintain the institutions and the butcher shops and the other facilities that make it a very attractive and comfortable place to be. I think that's really the main. I don't see major changes even over that period of time.
When you lived in Kansas City, were there any problems as a Jew?
I wasn't aware of any. Of course, those were primarily the years when I was a resident, and pretty much interested in that. But we were very fortunate in that we early affiliated with a congregation that had a young rabbi who was not much older than I was, and who from the very beginning we became warm, close, personal friends of Rabbi Abraham Karp and his wife Debbie, who really almost took us under their wing and our children, and we had someone with whom we spent holidays. And even after he left the rabbinate, actually he left Kansas City and became the rabbi of a big temple in Rochester, and then gave up the rabbinate to become professor of history at the University of Rochester. And over the years we maintained contact with him and have reestablished it, as my daughter now lives in Rochester, when we visit her, we'll often, you know, visit him.
What was the structure of the synagogue?
It was a conservative, a big conservative synagogue, and he was the young assistant rabbi. And when he left, the new young assistant rabbi was... I think all of a sudden I've gone blank on his name. Another young rabbi, you know, who again, with whom he became friends for the 4 years, who again left the rabbinate, and who had an MBA before he was a rabbi, and went back into the insurance business, Irving Frankel, Rabbi Frankel from Chicago, and who still to this day will volunteer for a little congregation to help them, but he said he enjoys being Jewish but not making a living from it. And so that the two rabbis with whom we were closest both left the rabbinate as a profession but remained committed and observant, you know, Jews.
During the Depression, you were very young. Did it have any particular harsh aspect on your family?
Not that I can really recall. Binghamton, as a town, was relatively better spared from the Depression than many other cities in America, in that Endicott Johnson, which you mentioned before, had a very paternalistic attitude toward its employees. It was the major employer in town. And when things got tight, nobody got fired. They worked 4 days a week or 3 days a week or 2 days a week. And even though there were no unions, they operated a health service for their employees, you know, and operated the local hospital. They had parks. They had vacation places. So that they really were spared the worst aspects of the Depression. Now, things were tough and tight. I remember as a kid, you know, you took your nickel or dime or penny to school to put in the school bank, and every 2 or 3 years when there were $5 or $10, you know, all of the kids in the family took out their money because you needed it to help pay for this or pay for that. But, you know, that wasn't a hardship. That was just normal. I mean, it never occurred to you that there was any different way. We always had enough to eat, and we were clothed, and we, you know, we had a house.
What did your father do?
My father had a little furniture store, and, you know, was in partners with his brother and brother-in-law, and he was the one who would go door to door, you know, try to sell and collect the accounts. It was very much that kind of of business. When eventually his brother left and his brother-in-law left, by the time he became 65, he was operating the business himself with my brother. And the urban renewal took the property, you know, and the business, and gave him a reasonable settlement, and he approached my brother and said, my son, I really am not terribly interested in going back into business, but will if you are interested. But it's obvious to me that you are not interested, because my brother was playing with the theater group and with this and with that, and had never taken business seriously. He said, if there's anything else you want to do, now's the time. You know, I'll help you. So during the last year, the business, he'd always wanted to be a broker. He said, go study, do whatever you want to do. And the minute he loved being a stockbroker and has been very happy at that ever since. And my father stayed retired for all of 3 or 4 months and then went to work for one of his competitors as a salesman. And
without the worries.
Retired at age 83. Primarily because my mother, may she rest in peace, needed help around the house. But he then worked from 65 to 83, you know, as a salesman for one of his former competitors, bringing a fair trade with him.
You're a motivated family.
Yeah.
Did any of your brothers serve during the war?
No, they were too young. I mean, I was at 18. I was 18 in 1944, 45, and 18 and 43. But we went into service in 44, so my brother was 9 years younger than I. The war was well over by the time he came along.
What do you do for vacations?
It's varied with the years. I mean, during the early years that we were here, when kids were in school, we would take off the month of August and go camping.
Really?
Yeah.
Where did you camp?
Well, during the years when we were in Kansas City, and that's when I bought the tent, when as a resident on a salary of $100 a month, I had a month's vacation. What do? The neighbors, you know, in the neighborhood, I had bought a house in Kansas City for $1,000 down at $47 a month, taxes, principal, interest, and insurance. And the neighbors would spend their vacation painting the house and working around the house, but I knew that that was a temporary waystone, so we bought the tent, and in that year era, we would go to the Smokies. I'm sorry, we would go to the Ozarks, or we would go to Colorado, to Rocky Mountain National Park, or we would go to Yellowstone. We went to Minnesota, you know, within 500, 1,000 miles of Kansas. There's a... Pardon me.
You have many areas.
Many areas. Then when we moved here, the camping pretty much ended because my wife said, enough already, I've had enough camping, and we would spend our time, you know, really, even in all those years, we always managed to get every year to visit to Boston, to Binghamton, to visit, you know, her mother and aunts and my relatives in Binghamton. The last few years, it seems I barely end up taking a vacation because there's so much obligatory. I mean, that's my business travel schedule for the next few months, and whatever vacation time I take now is really to spend a few days extra with this child or that child, or to go to Binghamton or go to Boston, because to travel, we're doing it all the time.
Well, and you can always take an extra day or two and and view the surroundings and enjoy them.
The one thing that I really haven't done is for a number of years, Esther's had a trouble and been unable to fly. So that we've had difficulty, and I haven't taken a trip to Israel for some time. The things that would require flying together, many of these I have to do alone, we've been unable to do. So when we go to Chicago, we drove. When we go to New York, we drive. When we go to Boston, we drive.
Well, I'm driving.
And it's only in the last year that we think we finally figured out what her problem was on airplanes. Esther had a problem with epilepsy. And the well-controlled and the only convulsions for the last 10 years have been during takeoff or landing in airplanes. And which makes one hesitant to fly.
Sure.
But we think we've got it licked, Ken and Horror, and the last year we were able to take 3 flights with no problem. So we'll
try
to
stretch that. Oh, I'm sure she's happy about that.
What?
I'm sure she's happy about that. You know, when you regard your children now, do you ever contrast the way you were raised with the way you're raising you raised your children?
Well, I guess you can't help but do that occasionally, but it's never been a major matter of concern. I think we raised them much more in the way that I was raised than many of their own contemporaries. I know one time my son Matthew complained, said, why don't we have the things that the other rich doctors' kids have? I said, it's because I made up my mind not to be a rich doctor. And that even to the degree that I have it, I made up my mind that you would not live like a rich doctor's kid. That one of the most powerful forces for good and for accomplishment that my generation and those preceding us had was the knowledge that by our own efforts, we could improve, you know, our status in life and our that we could make real progress. And that our parents knew that and helped us to do that, but we had that sense of accomplishments and creativity. I've seen too many kids in families where they had everything, where even if they're capable, it may be a matter of luck to achieve as much as their parents. And when you have a mother as bright as an intelligent as my wife with what she's done, and by luck what I've been able to do, you can have very competent, very good kids who may not be able to achieve the same. You don't want them to have the feeling that they're inadequate. You don't want them to have the feeling that they can't maintain the lifestyle to which they were accustomed, and that therefore feel that they're inadequate or feel disappointed. So that I told them I